Profiling Criminal Minds. I'm Dan.
And I'm Dr. Redmond.
You got it! You caught yourself.
I almost didn't.
Yeah, almost didn't, but you caught yourself. And we are back for, that's right, more Criminal Minds. It's kind of bonus fun this time, because we're going to be talking about three episodes that aren't The Inspiration or The Inspired. So that alone means we're going to have a better episode.
No, I've got to tell you something really funny. So I've got these, the discs. I've got
the disc from the library. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
The DVDs. And
the DVDs. And so they have special features.
Of course they do. Yeah.
Now, not of course. I mean,
oh, you're right. Some of them don't. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. We've been without special features for a while.
Many times. Yeah.
And, so what they do, all these special features talk up each of the episodes. Like it's just a little clip about what's in the episode, and they talk to either the writer,
the director, producer,
and I mean, Erica is at the beginning of one thing, and I'm just like, she was giving the overview to what they were planning on doing on season 9, and it turns out what she told everybody, she told the writing room before they went on hiatus, that what they had to do when they came back was to put together stories that nobody's ever seen before.
Oh my God. All right, keep going.
Yeah, right. And but the thing that I'm learning from watching these things, right, is I don't think we watch the same thing that they do. Like I'm going, well, yeah, okay. Like, it was really interesting because they did talk to Frederick Kohler for The Inspiration and The Inspired, right?
Okay.
And it's the same old story. And they talked to Larry Tang, who directed, and how they did, like, some of the blue screening with the doubles. And his double, right, who's in the background with the hat on all the time.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing, right?
Yeah, the fun stuff about shooting twins, yeah.
And Cameron Manheim, you know, and how they had to decide whether one or two. And then it's like,
are they missing the forest for the trees and they're only talking about the technical aspects? And it's like,
to some extent, no, yeah, they're talking about what they're trying to do and the rest of it. And I'm just going, okay, so that's what you were attempting to do. It might actually be interesting for you at some point to.
Oh no, I'm definitely going to watch this now that I've heard that there's information about it.
Yeah, because they're talking to the writers for the most part, and the directors, and of course all of the special guest stars get to talk. And Cameron Manheim and Frederick Kohler both were talking about how great this was and. Of course, I mean, everything is really, really positive, right? Everything.
Well, no, you would have to be. I mean, I understand why they want to be positive, but it's like, so no one working on it seems to have internalized just how awful these hours of television were. Like, yeah, no one gets it.
No, because I don't think they don't see the forest at all.
Like they're only looking at the trees of production and not asking themselves, what is the forest we are planting?
Yeah.
And the forest we're planting is a horrible nightmare. And it's like, literally, I know I said this last week, but I'll say it one more time. The only two episodes of Criminal Minds that I was actively pissed off that I was going to have to watch again.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, that's the only time in this whole project I've been actually pissed off that I was going to have to watch an episode again. And
yeah.
It's these two. And it's those two. So, yeah.
Yeah.
By comparison, the dumb nonsense we get this week is fine. Just fine.
And it's so, but S.A. Morales did tell us how wonderful this crew, like these actors and everything, and what a welcoming and wonderful set this is.
That's nice.
It's so nice to know.
He will be in 7 more episodes and that's it. And then they'll just forget they have a boss.
Yeah. Yes, to the detriment of the entire thing.
No.
But anyway, it doesn't get any better.
No, it doesn't. All right, so let's go for it.
Let's go. To Bear Witness. written by Erica Messer, of course. Yeah. When a Baltimore, Maryland John Doe is subjected to lobotomy, and found with a microscopic camera embedded in his eye, the BAU works with new section chief Mateo Cruz to profile an abductor with ties to an international cold case. Well, it wasn't a cold. It was a year old.
I think by their standards, it might be a cold case.
Yeah. Okay. Meanwhile, JJ and Cruz attempt to keep their past relationship secret from the team.
Okay.
Yeah. So, what was I going to say? So this is an ode to German child rearing.
No, yeah, I mean, not, it doesn't, that's the weird part. Like, the episode isn't about that, but if you know anything about Germans, it is. It accidentally becomes that.
From my perspective,
let's but just say German parenting is not emulated.
I just finished teaching a first-year class about the German peasant war, right? Oh. And then I showed them this peasant, at the end, they had to listen to this peasant folk song. And yeah. That was, I think it was probably created in the 19th century or 18th, 19th century, but it was later about the peasant war, right?
Right.
Just like, I'm listening to this. And of course, the way it sounds, it's been put to, it sounds like it's Rammstein. Some guy came up to me and and he says to me, he said, I really like that, you know, and blah, and it reminds me. And I said, yeah, you know, I said that the German band, you know, the heavy metal group, and he's looking at me. I said, Ich will. And he says, oh, Rammstein. Yeah, Rammstein. I said, that's what it, I said, it's not Metallica, no way, but Rammstein, it sounds like. I said, yes, it's German. Yeah. They made it definitely sound German.
The intense,
but anyway,
bellowing metal. Yeah.
Yeah, it was. Behind the marching and the song, but the song lends itself to that, and it was, as I said, written in probably the 19th century about the German peasant war. And I had to look around to find a proper English translation along the bottom, right? Because all of the German, like, I'm watching this one and I'm going, okay, I don't know who did the German English translation, but there's clearly a problem with this as I'm listening to it, and then going, okay. And then I finally
were they trying to change the point of the song, or
not exactly, but they were leaving out the worst parts of the song, and you know, it was just like, and so I did finally find one though that did translate it properly, and you know, you need it. I mean, it was a horrible thing. You can understand why it happened, but you know. Anyway, never mind. Let's get back to this episode of the microscopic camera embedded in his eye.
Come on! Apparently, we're now just having science fiction on the show.
Apparently they exist.
The problem is not that unbelievably small cameras exist. I know unbelievably small cameras exist. How is an unbelievably small camera broadcasting? You have to, where is it? Like, you tell me you've got a camera that's the size of a human hair? Well, no, like 10 times the size of a human hair. But, like, yeah, of course you can. But it has to be plugged into something. Like, it has to have a power supply. And it has to have a way to broadcast. You can't just stick a camera in someone's eye.
Well, I don't know. I'm assuming it did. I'm assuming that it had this really, 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 as you say, sci-fi kind of power base within it that could also do Wi-Fi.
Well, that's my point. The fact that the show has to resort to doing ridiculous sci-fi gibberish. There you go.
Oh, but I did find out something about research. I'll have to talk about this again for a sec. So Sharon Lee Watson is talking about her episode, which was Final Shot.
Okay.
And she was talking about
her research, which came from watching the movie Jack Reacher and reading the book One Shot.
Well, no, I won't. She doesn't even mention it.
Well, of course she doesn't mention it. She doesn't want to get sued. Of course she doesn't mention it.
No, she talks about the dream sequence. So she talked to obviously one guy who had been a sniper who had used this method of.
Yeah, of the keeping yourself awake by telling the stories. But yeah, we talked never about went it last week.
No. But you go further than this. Here's the longer research part of it, right? Whereas that's where she stops. Oh, right. That'll make a good episode. Yeah, I mean, we're not real. So, but we now know, because then Erica Messer starts talking, and one of the other ones is talking about how the writers do their own research now. They don't have an actual research on staff. That's what I took away from, because I just watched the special features for each episode.
Right.
And what I take away from it, right, is that they now are personally responsible, each of them, for their own research. And they're not researchers.
Nope. They don't know where to look. They don't understand how to look for larger context. Okay. Well, yeah, this explains so much.
Yeah, it explains a lot. Like, we sort of figured
especially
they had
the sci-fi gibberish we get this week.
Oh, yeah. But,
I read in a book, magazine that they can make cameras the size of a hair. Great. Well, what if you put that in someone's eye? Perfect. Done. That's the end of the research.
Erica Messer. She doesn't have time for research.
To be fair, she is running a whole TV show.
Yeah.
But maybe when you're running a whole TV show, find some room in the budget for a professional research staff.
Yeah. Well, no, but they're all too smart to.
Oh, you're right, to have to do that.
They know how to go on the internet, and that's all they need.
And if you're wondering why we're delaying talking about this episode much, it's because there's, again, almost nothing to the episode, because literally, like, they've got a guy in the hospital at the start of the episode who knows everything.
Yeah.
And literally, all they have to do, and by the way, when Derek walks into the room, he has been told by the doctors that the guy can't communicate.
Yeah.
First off, I don't know why a doctor isn't there with him for all of that, but okay. But it's like, and what drives me crazy is they like, let's try blinking. And as I was watching the episode for the first time, I'm like, they have boards with letters on them that are used, that exist only for situations like this. And then to the show's credit, they do bring out the word board eventually. But like, why wouldn't you start with the word board?
Well,
you start with blinking?
Because maybe Derek didn't know about the word board.
That's why there should be a doctor in the room with him.
Well, yes, I know. But don't you know that the BAU profilers are smarter than anybody else in the world, and they know everything?
Which actually, that by the way, you want to talk about the show trying what's a nice way to say, there's no nice way to say it, so I'm just gonna say really fluff the BAU. At the end of this episode, the FBI comes to arrest the killer. Well, he doesn't actually he has killed one person. Yes, he has killed one person, the killer. And they're like, aren't you the people who are going to ask me why I did it? I'm like, why would you assume that the guy who kicked down the door to arrest you is the guy who asks you why you did it? No. Yeah, that is what the BAU is for. But you have no reason to assume that the person kicking down the door would be the BAU.
Well, like, plus he doesn't even know about the BAU, probably.
Exactly. No, but in the world of Criminal Minds, everyone knows about the BAU and exactly what they do, and that they're the best of the best.
Yeah.
And that is the ridiculousness of this show and its treatment of these characters. Because it's so frustrating to watch, because it's like, literally, and then they have Derek do the running his finger along the board and having him blink again. It's like, you've already established that this guy's hands work fine. He can, he can't write because that part of his brain is broken, but he can, his hand works. He can point. Just give him the vision board and let him point. Ask him a question. He'll spell out the answer.
Yeah.
Like, it's so frustrating. frustrating to watch because it's like they're missing basic stuff, like day one basic stuff about how to deal with people who are having communications issues.
And this is 2013. They could have actually given him a tablet or a computer.
They could have just put a keyboard in front of him. Let him type. Why are you doing all this board stuff? Just let him type. The board is only there for people who are completely immobilized and can only do by blinking or, when it showed up in Breaking Bad, by ringing a bell, right? Like, and the thing is, Hector in Breaking Bad, no, he legitimately, he can't talk and he can't point. His body basically doesn't work.
Yeah.
And so he has to do the ding with the board, the talking board.
Yeah.
Right? But this guy can point. Presumably he can type. I mean, you might say, oh, well, his, and I was going to say, you might say his brain doesn't remember to spell things, but it does because that's how he uses the board. I was about to make an excuse for them, but no. Like, there's no reason you can't just put a tablet, like you say, in front of this guy or a laptop and just let him type out what's going on. It's going to take a while. He's in bad shape. But it's a lot faster than asking him to blink based on a text board.
And they would have gotten Dana instead of Danny.
Exactly. They would have gotten there so much faster. Well, he would have just written her whole name. He would have just written his whole name. Like, they could have been there X amount faster. I mean, they wouldn't have saved her. Like, the killer had already done everything.
Yeah.
So, like, and that's another frustrating thing about this episode. They accomplish nothing. All he wanted to do was lobotomize his sister and then turn himself over to the cops.
Yeah, and he did.
And he did. Which, by the way, how frustrating is that scene where it's like, we're going to try to bluff him. And I'm like, but what were you hoping the bluff would accomplish?
Yeah, like, I had no idea. It was just like.
Yeah, it's like
they have no way to profile this guy yet.
Yeah, well, they have no information about who he is. They don't know what he wants. They don't know anything. So there's let's try to bluff and say we know who you are. But it's like, since you have no information about who he is or what he wants, that could have gone terribly wrong. He could have believed you and that second have immediately killed his hostage. Like, what was the bluff supposed to accomplish?
Yeah, I have no idea. I have no idea. This was just, well, it's the usual mess, you know?
Oh, yeah. A messer, if you will. Ugh, why would I do that? It helped nothing. No, I'm ashamed.
Well, it is, it is ultimately a rather appropriate name.
Yeah.
That she has. It's her real name. So.
Yeah, it is a real name. It's like I'm only making fun of it a little. But no, what it comes down to is you watch this episode and you're like, from minute to minute, like, I don't know what they think they're trying to accomplish. It's one of those situations where the writer, in this case, the showrunner, has come up with a situation that, like, and it's like when you're watching an episode of Luther, right? And you're like, oh my God, they're in this impossible situation, like they have created an impossible situation for John Luther, right? And how is he gonna, and you wonder, how is he gonna figure his way around this? Yeah. And the answer is brilliant. He, while the guy, what you didn't realize was he had talked to the SWAT team. So all he had to do was like, he makes it believe that the RPG guy he's playing with, that he's playing the game, but really he's just trying to get him to the back end of the truck so they can shoot up the one end of the truck and kill the guy. It's a brilliant scene in that episode.
Yeah.
You're like, how is he going to get out of this one? They thought it through. Whereas in this is what happens when a writer who's not very good or smart does the same thing. They can come up with a terrifying situation, but they can't come up with the next step of how the characters deal with it. So they just have the characters fail, but get really indignant about failing so it can seem like they succeeded. And it's like, they've got to, and it's so pathetic, their attempts, that they have to try to come up with a win whenever, which is, oh, well, his dad is trying to get him extradited to Germany, but I called my friend at the State Department and that's not going to happen. I'm like, yeah, that's not going to happen today, but he just got arrested today. You're going to go on to the next thing and he's going to keep lobbying.
And he is going to be, you know why he's going to go back to Germany?
Yeah.
Because murder
Yep.
Is
a more serious crime than kidnapping and torture. Yes. Because kidnapping and torture is bad. Both those people are still alive. The guy he killed in Germany is dead. Spoiler alert, he's going to go back to Germany. S.A.? Like, he just is.
Yeah. And I...
And the show, like, doesn't seem to understand how flat their attempt to get a win out of this for the characters falls.
Ugh. If they had saved the girl...
Then they would have a win.
They would have a win.
But they don't.
But they don't.
And the thing is, and it's like, if they had saved her, right? If they had saved her, then it's a win for the team, and it's a win for the lobotomized character, because the information he gave them, even though he was crippled, was able to help and save the day, right?
And as far as I'm concerned, I mean, that was if that's the biggest problem I have with the episode, that's it. It's like, I'm sorry, but you don't set this up and do this.
That's my point. It goes back to them being too in love with their killers and having no interest in their victims.
Oh, well, you should hear her talk about the actor who plays the killer.
Oh, no. I mean, don't get me wrong. I love David Anders. I think he's great.
Okay? Oh, yeah. No. It's just what you said before about how they're in love with the killers, right?
Yeah.
And she goes out of her way to get this guy, you know, that anyway, never mind. You'd have to, you'll.
No, I will watch them. I will watch it.
And you'll just
they're like, she's like, I knew I wanted him for this part because I always loved him on Alias or whatever. And like,
yeah, well, I'd worked with him before in Alias. And so I
okay.
She tells the whole story
of how she like wrote the part with him in mind. But that's the problem.
Yes. That's the problem.
That's the problem.
You know, so she wants to give him a happy ending.
Jesus Christ.
You know, I mean,
she's essentially making me angry now.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God.
No, like I'm sitting there because basically he has a happy ending.
He does?
Oh, they try and make it not a happy ending because his father walks past him without even acknowledging his existence. Oh, fuck off.
I know. By the way, that's how all German dads act all the time.
You should know.
No, oh, I know. But anyway.
Even
so yes.
Grandfather's act.
To bear witness. It's not a very good episode because it falls into the trap they always do of fetishizing the killer. And even though we spent a bunch of time with one of the victims this week, not really caring about the victim's experience. Time and again, this is what they do. And it's one of the worst things about the show.
It would have been such a good show if they had managed.
Oh, if they had saved her, if they had used their, you know, abilities and our Garcia had teamed up and blah, 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 blah. And they had gotten there in time. I mean, it would have been a stretch, but you would have said, yep, that's great. I am happy with how this episode turned out. But no, they have to have him win.
Yeah.
And it's like, this is when I came up with my thing for it's like, how good did they do this week? I started noticing that I have to give zeros for times when the killer wins. Because sometimes the killer wins. And everything they wanted to accomplish, like they have these mission-based murderers, or in this case just, you know, kidnappers, but these mission-based people who just want to accomplish something, and the show lets them accomplish it.
Well, yeah, let's go to Route 66. That leads us right into Route
66.
Well,
you're right. That is a perfect
segue.
Transition.
With Hodge hospitalized due to complications resulting from the stab wounds received during his near-fatal encounter with George Foyette, and Rossi staying behind to obtain word on his prognosis, the remaining members of the VAU set out to track down a Wichita, Kansas teenager believed to have been abducted by her estranged father. First of all, Rossi doesn't stay behind. He finds out what's wrong, and he immediately goes to Wichita, Kansas.
Yeah, so, I know. That's a weird thing to say.
Yeah, that's a weird thing to say. Garcia stays behind and stays at the hospital.
She stays at the hospital
and works
and she
her
does
magic
all of her
from
work
the hospital
from
over her laptop. Yeah. Well, yeah, okay.
I mean, honestly, this is one of those situations where he was in the last episode, just, you know, cut to Kevin working the station while she stays at the hospital. That would have been fine. Mm-hmm. But they don't want to give Kevin a job other than on the phone, so.
Yeah, well, yeah, Kevin got his on the phone last
previous week, yeah.
episode, yes. And she's still a bitch. But anyway, hodgepodge. Okay, oh, and God. It was very nice to see Hayden again.
No, it was.
And, you know.
Haley.
I mean, that's the funny thing, is this is the second or the third time, I think, where you can say they have done a section with Hotch.
Yeah.
Right? That works as a, it could work as a mini little all little by movie itself. Thing.
Yeah, all by itself. Yep.
Yeah,
and the thing is, I'm so fond of this episode just because of how much I enjoy the little interspace subconscious thing that Hotch goes through. I think it's really well written. I think it's very well acted by everybody.
Yeah.
Like, it's just such a fun scene.
Yeah, it really was.
It's a really good scene, right down to just on some level, that his subconscious has created this situation where he knows that throughout, like, the idea in his head, he will never be able to separate the memory of Haley from the memory of the Reaper.
Yeah.
So in his head, the Reaper has been transformed.
Yes.
into this, like, pleasant, cheery guy who's now, because he's part of their family story, in his head, he's now a family friend.
Yes.
Like, that's such a great way to do it.
Yeah, and Haley invites him there.
Yeah, invites him because he's part of their story now.
Yeah.
He can't ever not be part of their story. And the thing is, with him, with Jack, with everybody, like, this killer is always going to be part of the story. So how do you reconcile that subconsciously? And the thing is, you transform him into just a garrulous figure who's like a friendly uncle. It's such a weird thing to do, but it's so smart, right?
And and that part is so smart. And this was written by Virgil Williams, right? Who
consistently one of the better writers on the show.
On and off, he's got
He has done as bad episodes as any of them.
Yeah, but this.
But when we get an episode that does something emotionally true, there is a better than average chance it's a Virgil Williams episode. I think
but
that's.
You know what's funny about this?
What's that?
Okay. Is that, of course, it's the fight between Virgil Williams and...
And Thomas Gibson that gets him fired.
Thomas Gibson fired. I mean, when I watched this, that's what I was thinking about. I'm just going,
it's so crazy.
It's so crazy because this is, as I said, it could be like these little mini, remember? I mean, there's the Boston one, and then there's the one where he's in jail with the guy, right? Yeah. There's three of them. With Hotch that can be actually just you could
set aside and you learn huge stuff about Hotch and you do really good storytelling about in both the Boston one and the one he's in jail about the psychological stuff underpinning the stories they tell.
Yeah.
Right. And it's when they take a step away from having to catch a killer this week, right? You can do something really interesting with the psychology and especially with Aaron.
Yeah.
And most of the time we just don't get that. Like the show doesn't have time to do that because it's busy with, well, who's the killer this week? And this week, like there's a guy on the run and he keeps getting people trying to interrupt him. So he kills people along the way because he just wants to fix stuff from his own past.
Yeah.
And you know, that's fine. Like, that's, the episode itself, like, is just, okay, that's great. But, you know, that's not the big, oh my God, I can't believe I forgot to mention something about last week's episode. I'm going to jump in.
Just go back one.
Not last week's. The first episode this week.
Yeah.
This week has a couple of just infuriating things from Spencer Reed. But one of the most infuriating things he's ever said was in trying to make a story about how smart Spencer Reed is, he tries to say that you can solve a crossword without looking at the clues based on the frequency of the amount of words that turn up. And I just want to say, if someone watched that scene and listened to that dialogue and thought Spencer Reed sounded smart, he's not. He's an idiot. He is describing making a crossword puzzle, not solving a crossword puzzle. There are so many words in the English language that any grid can have any number of different words stuffed in there and still be a legitimate crossword puzzle. That's how crossword puzzles are created.
You find a layout grid. You know who we blame for that?
Who do we blame for that?
The writer.
Oh, you're right. I guess we have to blame the writer for that one. As if we hadn't said enough bad about her yet today. You're describing making a crossword. How can you get this so wrong? How can you get everything so wrong?
Well, because she doesn't do crossword puzzles.
Yeah, she doesn't do crossword puzzles.
I'll give you 10 to 1. Because even this whole thing, right? A crossword puzzle, I would assume they're doing the New York Times crossword puzzle.
No, it's not the New York Times. She's doing one of the cryptic crosswords.
Oh, yeah. Okay, a cryptic crossword.
Yeah, cryptic, where it's like two words and then you have to reverse engineer the really cryptic thing it means. So it might be London Times cryptic.
Oh, yeah, you're explaining to other people.
I'm not explaining to you. Some people don't know about cryptic crossword puzzles.
Yeah.
Because they are a far more obscure, mostly British newspaper.
Yes, thing. I was going to say, yeah, the Brits will do all of this.
Oh, no, they love that stuff.
I'm never terribly fond of cryptics, but I do them. I do logic problems a lot.
Yeah, no, I mean, you like logic puzzle books. I just like the standard crossword puzzle where it's just figure out a thing. Like, and it's mostly just people don't understand that crossword puzzles, I guess, are mostly just trivia quizzes, really. Because it's about events, or every now and then there'll be a clever, turn of phrase, but mostly it is about events. It is about who did what where. It is a reference to a thing. It is about knowing synonyms. Like, it's a general knowledge quiz in the form of a word puzzle, right?
Which is why I did always, you see, and that's the thing, because they do have, crossword puzzle books. Like, crossword puzzles are, people don't realize that until you go, because I've been finding some old, like 20 years ago. And there's all sorts of references in there that are cultural references.
That now,
it's
when you
really
look at
weird.
It.
I'm looking at this and I all of a sudden have to go back and go, oh, frig, did I ever watch that TV show? You know?
It's so funny because I got this book of crossword puzzles. And I'm like, I got this book of crossword puzzles, just because... it's something I enjoy doing, is just having a whole book and going through them while I'm doing something, while I'm watching something else. I'll just do a crossword puzzle at the same time because I need to keep my mind active. And I read it and I'm like, how old are the puzzles from this book? It's like, I bought it this year and it was printed recently, but it's like, they're just reprinting puzzles from the 70s. There's quizzes about the Love Boat in there. Like, come on, guys.
Come on.
Okay, so yeah, that has been our... a extended statement about how much we don't like that Erica Messer doesn't understand what a crossword puzzle is. Let's move on to the actual meat of this episode, which is, again, it's a second episode where there's like not a ton to the actual story. It's just a question of they have to figure out where he's going. And that's as simple as just, well, you know who he is already.
Yeah.
He was going to Mexico. This wasn't always his plan to do this suicide run out to California, right? And it's this interesting situation because they never really like know the guy very well, right? They never really get a good sense of him because his daughter is never in any kind of danger, right? And here's how badly, and this is their failure to profile him and understand him, because you watch this scene, right, where he shoots the guy in the gas station.
Yeah.
And later they come and they see the scene, and it's interesting because you watch them misread a situation, and they never found out how badly they misread the situation, because they're like, why didn't he go for the gun underneath the table, right? And the answer is, it's like, it probably just caught him unawares because he's a cold-blooded murderer. And of course, we know, because we saw the scene, that the guy did go for the shotgun. That's why he shot him.
Yeah.
He shot him because the guy reached for the shotgun. He would have just left. You know? He cut the phone to keep the guy from calling, because he thought the guy might figure it out and kept him calling. But as they say... if the guy has already called for help, right? If the guy has already called for help, there's no reason to kill him. It doesn't accomplish anything. And I don't believe the guy was planning to kill him. There's nothing about his demeanor, what he's doing, but we see the guy reach for the shotgun and then we hear the gunshots. And I'm like, okay, well, now we know why he did that.
Yeah.
And the second time he shoots a guy because he's being attacked.
Yep.
So again, oh, by the way, they say the craziest thing in the episode, which is he took the guy's wallet, which he must have done to keep him from being investigated. He's not hurting for cash. What do you mean he's not hurting for cash? He robbed a diamond wholesaler. You can't, like, he's on the road. You can't give a diamond necklace at a gas station for
gas. This is what I was going to say. You can't pay for gas with diamonds.
Diamonds? Like, what a stupid thing to say. No, I'm sure he stole that guy's wallet to take. And so it's like, I'm watching them, and it's kind of fascinating as I'm watching the episode, because I'm watching them misread this guy over and over again.
Yeah.
Right?
Right to the end.
Right. Where they think that the daughter might be in danger. It's like everything they say about this guy is just wrong. Everything they guess about him is wrong.
You think they would have figured this out when they saw the video from the robbery?
Yes.
That he didn't. It was his partner that betrayed him. Yeah. Not him betraying his partner.
And that's what gets me about the episode. They find this, you know, thing that is a seismic shift in what should be their interpretation of the guy.
And they
doesn't really change their profile of the guy. And I don't know why. Like, I don't know why they're not seeing how wrong they were about the whole time, and or why they can't admit they were just wrong about him the whole time. And in the end, they treat him like they would anyone else in that situation, which is give him the old platitude about how your daughter, you know, don't let your daughter see you die. But honestly, it's the friggin' daughter that talks him out of killing himself.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
And it's like having you, and it's like, as she said, just like having you, like, whatever you've done, I know you love me, and having you alive is better than seeing you die.
Yeah.
Whatever the situation in which you're alive is. And it's like, and in the end, the daughter talks him out of killing himself.
No, and I think that this section with JJ was good too. Like, yes. I'm beginning to see, okay, here's where Virgil Williams' strengths are. And they are in the writing
personal stuff.
Like, totally. I mean, that's
absolutely
sort of,
I agree with
like
that.
You're going, oh, okay. So now we know where his strengths lie.
Completely.
Yeah.
Because then you get the touching scene at the end of the episode where they're all talking about the absent friends and family on Dia de los Muertos.
Yeah.
And that's a nice scene.
Oh, but that's in the next episode.
That's not this episode? All right. Well, now I've just humiliated myself quite a bit. I'm so sorry, everybody, for forgetting. But no, that was another nice character scene that we get in the next episode. But you're right, that this one, it's frustrating as you watch this episode, because you watch them fail at profiling and not internalize their failures.
Well, yes, but they don't fail. They're perfect.
Everyone knows who they are. They're, you know, internationally famous superheroes, and they can never be seen as fallible.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very frustrating thing to watch.
Periodically, you just go crazy watching it.
You do, right?
Yep.
But yeah, but I think for whatever we may have problems with the main story of this episode, the actual drama, I like the Haley and Hotch stuff so much that I'm completely fine with the episode as a whole.
Yeah, and I mean, you walk out of that episode and you're so happy, like, you can say that it's when I did my segue. But the thing is, yes, he does accomplish what he sets out to accomplish, except for killing himself. So
yes,
that's what makes this work. And the daughter, you know, who has been adoring, I mean, and she's going to go back to her mother and go, oh, well, Mom, I guess I was a little out of line.
Yeah. Well, but it's like, and also her boyfriend was a rapist. Jesus.
Yeah, her boyfriend.
That gets glossed over pretty quickly.
Pretty quickly, yeah.
Like, yeah, no, the dad. Yeah, yeah, like that guy needed to get his ass kicked.
Yep.
Like, it was kind of strange. Although I honestly don't know why they're getting an Amber Alert about this. Like,
she's too old.
An Amber. Not only that, but it's like they're three states away. Why is he getting an Amber Alert in Virginia about something that's happening three states away? It's weird because the episode starts with him with Hotch getting an Amber Alert about her. Like, you're very far away. I find it a little preposterous when I get an Amber Alert from Toronto, you know, because I live in the whole other end of the province.
Look, I get those Amber Alerts in Sault Ste.
From Toronto. And you're in Sault Ste. Marie, which is actually, yeah. Well, no, You're even farther.
I'm closer to Toronto than you are. You can get
and spoiler there. Alert, I can't stress this enough, nobody's driving to Sault Ste. Marie. People might drive to Ottawa from Toronto. Nobody's driving to Sault Ste. Marie from Toronto.
Unless they got family here.
Or unless they want to get away with a crime. Here's a true story from when I visited you in Sault Ste. Marie. When I was driving into the city, there was a ambulance and fire wagon and police car in front of a house because there had been a death there, and it had recently happened when I was driving into the city. And this is a true fact. I drive by that location for the next 2 days, and whenever I drove by that location, there was still a police SUV sitting in front of the house. And on the third day I was in the city, the crime scene investigation van was in front of the house. And at that moment, I realized, oh my God, Sault Ste. Marie is so out of the way and their police is so underfunded that they had to wait 3 days for the crime scene people to drive up from North Bay, meaning a cop had to sit there 24 hours a day watching the house to make sure no one went in or out and nothing got tampered with before the crime scene people got there. So I'm just saying, if you want to get away with a crime, Sault Ste. Marie might be a pretty good place to do it.
Yeah, well, it was, yes, and as I said, and it was actually not North Bay. They would have come from Sudbury.
Sudbury, you're right. They would have come from Sudbury.
But I can still, I mean, for heaven's sakes, my mother had a raccoon in her attic, right?
Yeah.
So she needed to call the animal control because the city wasn't doing this. They had outsourced it, right?
Oh.
So the city isn't doing it. The guy had to come all the way from Sudbury. We don't even have
3.5 hours to come and deal with a raccoon.
Yeah.
Oh, that's ludicrous. But anyway.
Never mind.
No, but living honestly, like, that's what the boonies are like. And that's the thing. It's like, it's not that it's a terrible episode. It's just weird because it shows these holes in what they can do, and it's to the show's detriment that they refuse to accept or admit the fallibility of their characters.
Yeah.
I would find these people so much more interesting if the show could admit it when they got it wrong.
Yeah, it would be nice, but I don't even know if the writers know that they're getting it wrong. I don't think the writers don't seem to understand that they're trying to write a reality show, a true story, sort of.
Yeah.
Like they're trying to tell the true story of the BAU in some ways, right?
Oh, absolutely.
And yet, at the same time, they don't bother writing a real story. It's like they've lost sight of the characters, and they've lost sight of the fact that the BAU doesn't always do well.
No. In fact, they frequently don't. There's a whole season of television we just covered on Mindhunter about how the BAU, they try and they try and they try, but, you know, like, there's a limit to what they can do. And yeah, Wayne Williams probably killed at least one or two of those people, but he didn't kill all of those kids. But at
doesn't
a certain point,
like it. Yeah.
No, it doesn't look like he killed all of those. I mean, he definitely killed a couple of people,
sure,
but he didn't kill all of them.
It's an interesting, but yeah.
Yeah, but it's so weird that we have, at the same time that Criminal Minds is out there, we have Mindhunter, especially with that amazing second season, doing a much better job of talking about the good and the bad of the BSU, later BAU. Like, they're showing this as a fully human endeavor, right? Not just, I mean, I'll use the words of Ed Bernero, knights who ride in and slay a dragon and go away. And that is what, and he's right, that is the role that we have chosen to give them in our national narrative, but that doesn't make it true.
Yeah, and that's funny because there was an article and I didn't read it. I just kind of skimmed a little of the beginning of it and thought, well, I'll go back and read it later, and I will at some point.
Okay.
But they're just talking about, I think it was about how Criminal Minds has sort of reshaped the narrative about profiling.
Yeah.
And the BAU, and or has it? I mean, it asks the question, basically.
Of course.
You know, and it isn't interesting because, but they don't stick. They treat this as if these people not always are knights rising, because if they were always the knights riding in to rescue, then the woman would not have been lobotomized into
fitness. Well, and this is the problem when you get 9 seasons in, sometimes writers would rather tell the dragon story.
Well, yeah, they're always telling the dragon.
Well, yes, but I'm saying sometimes they want the dragon to win is I guess what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, and sometimes we're sitting there going, well, maybe they want the dragon to
win all the time.
Well, most of the time, because they really like the
dragon. That's how it friggin' feels.
Sometimes
George Foyette, right friggin' there.
Yeah.
As much as we liked his appearance here, well, let's not forget how stupid all the cops had to be for have him get away with what he wanted to do.
Yeah.
So there you go. All right. So let's move on to our final episode of the week, which is the Halloween episode.
When a Provo, Utah Jane Doe is found buried in a tomb of rocks, and a second Jane Doe is found in the same vicinity, the BAU sets out to track down a ritualistic killer obsessed with Salem witchcraft, the Salem witch trials. Meanwhile, Garcia prepares to host a Day of the Dead celebration at her apartment, and Hotch returns from his leave of absence. So can I make 2 comments?
Go. Start it off with all the comments you want.
Well, first of all, the Day of the Dead celebration.
Yeah.
So I had 2 students from Mexico in my last
course,
right?
Yeah.
And these are what you might call, what we now call conversation circles, essentially, to get comfortable with the language, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's really what it functioned as.
Yeah.
So they're talking, and for whatever reason, I can't even remember why it came up, but they were talking about the things that Canadians ask them or think that they're going to, you know, this is how they're going to, you know, show how open they are about, you know, people in Mexico and stuff, and they understand things about Mexico. Right. And the 2 of them are all from cities. They're all well educated. And so anyway, and they're all looking, and one of them says, do people tell you about the Day of the Dead? And when the other guy goes, oh, yeah, she says, what Day of the Dead? She says, we don't celebrate this.
It's not a real thing in Mexican culture.
Well, it probably
It is a real thing, but it's not as big.
It's very limited.
Big as North American culture would have you believe.
Yeah, it's just like, it's like if you think that all people are Santeria, for example, right?
Yeah.
Or they're the bad version, as we've talked about on the show.
Quite a bit.
Right. It's just like, yeah, but they do tend to be. But the Day of the Dead would tend to be a rural.
Yeah,
probably more than
it's honestly out. Like asking. It's honestly like asking people with Greek heritage how much they feel about, you know, the Fields of Elysium. Well, that's part of our heritage. But no, it's not a, you know, a thing we talk about every day.
Yeah. The Fields of Elysium. Oh, yeah. Okay. What were those again? Yeah, I didn't get the good education that some of these other people had.
Yeah.
But anyway, it was funny.
That is pretty funny. Okay. That it is one of these things where I think writers want it to be a bigger thing than it actually is because it provides such good dramatic opportunity.
Oh, yeah. No, and it was fun in Garcia. And like, I'm not dissing the scene within the show. It was just funny to me because I probably, if I hadn't had those students, I probably wouldn't have even thought of
noticed it.
Right.
Oh no, because it's as a scene, because, as a character piece, it works.
Yeah. Because her father is, you know, I mean, her father would
stepfather.
Probably,
yeah.
Her stepfather would, no, adoptive father.
No step. Oh, you're right. Adoptive father.
Adoptive
yes.
father would have been like these like, the people that were in my class.
No,
right?
No, it is stepfather. It's the mother's second husband. Yeah, it is stepfather. Because the adopted, we see him in a flashback and he is Hispanic. And her younger half-brothers are all. So it's like she was a baby when her mother remarried. And so that's why she goes by Penelope Garcia.
Yeah.
No, it is her stepfather who was the Hispanic one. It's not her adoptive parents because she didn't get adopted until she was like 17 or something. Like her parents didn't die until she was like 16 or 17 or something. So it is her stepfather who was Garcia.
Okay. Well, that doesn't.
I mean, it's not important, okay. But I just remembered
yes.
the details
okay.
of her parents dying, and that's that was the detail.
Okay.
But anyway,
now,
continue.
Now, okay. The other thing is that at the end, Reed, and I have to just say this right now, because I'll forget it, but it was that I finished watching the episode and went, when we got to Reed explaining about how nobody ever got
burned.
Yeah.
Nobody ever burned in America, which is true.
Well, nobody ever got burned with the Salem witch trials. And I'm going, you know, you just kind of cut the rug from under the entire episode.
Although people did get crushed and hanged, but yeah, I know it's.
But
like,
why did you? Why? Yeah, but the last one was going to be burned, right?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden he goes, "Fun fact."
Fun fact. That's not historically accurate. Well, at the beginning of the episode, you, a man with a supposedly eidetic memory, misquoted Dirty Harry. So maybe we shouldn't go by you, Reed. Can't even get the most famous quote in, like, film fiction of the 70s right?
Well, we have to remember and blame the writer for this.
Yeah, but the thing is, it's like, YouTube exists. You can go to YouTube and type in, make my day speech, and then you can just transcribe what gets said.
But as I said, they all do their own research, right?
And some of them don't bother.
We now know the problem.
Yeah, you're right. The fact that they all do their own research is what causes all of these problems.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny. And what bothers me about the episode is, well, first off, and Reed does something else insufferable where, like, they're at a salt mine. And he's like, you know, imagine how many salt shakers this is filled up. And Reed's like, well, actually, most of the mine's salt goes to roads. And I'm like, yeah, but it still would fill up a lot of salt shakers. Even if 90% of the salt coming out of the mine, that's still, you know, friggin' a lot of salt for salt shakers. You're trying to show off your intelligence, but you just come off like you're trying to be a dick,
yeah,
Reed.
Yeah, to this guy. Yeah.
You're being a dick to this guy for no reason. Just, again, because you're trying to put him in his place. And I'm like, the fact that you're so desperate to put people in their place tells us a lot about you, Reed. Again, you still make people call you doctor, even though you're a 35-year-old man. Like, and it's funny, because we had someone mention, like, we had a commenter mention that the reason Reed does that is mentioned in the first episode, because he's too young for the job, so Jason wanted to make sure people took him seriously. And I'm like, yeah, I totally understand why they did it when he was 25. But he's a 34-year-old man, and he still dresses and has the hair of a teenager, and he still insists people call him doctor. At a certain point, you have to grow up. Or, in the case of Reed, he doesn't. He doesn't have to grow up ever. Because everyone will keep covering for him. But let's talk about the actual plot of the episode and how absurd it is that people who are freaking supposedly completely familiar with the history of psychopathy and madness in America don't see a woman crushed to death with rocks and immediately think, oh, like it's Salem.
Yeah.
Like, that's the first thing you think when you see a giant pile of rocks on top of a person. And especially, like, because the thing is, if you would build a cairn over somebody after they died, it can mean any number of things.
Yeah.
But if the ME tells you this person was crushed to death by the rocks, then you say, okay, well, that's what they did to witches. Famously, that's what they did to witches. They were pressed to death.
Yeah.
And they put you down on the ground, they put a big board over you, and they just piled rocks on top of you until you were dead. And it's horrific. It is horrific, but it's like, it's the first thing you would think. So the idea that it takes them so long in the episode to get to witchcraft is kind of crazy.
Yeah.
Oh, and, but yeah, and then, of course, they just go through the random search, and they do, well, who has historical background, and they find out that the brand on the neck is the brand of the family, like, is the family arms of a famous witch hunter. And so then they search
He's not a witch hunter, he's the judge.
You're right, the judge who convicted people at Salem, and you're right, my bad. And they're like, so, okay, does he have family and blah, 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 blah. And here's going to be my question.
Okay.
And this is what I was left with when I was rewatching the episode. I don't understand why this guy did any of this.
No, I don't either.
Okay, so it's not just me, right?
No, like, I sat there and I went, well,
why would
finding out that the Salem, that the, witch trials, that the guy is part of your genetic heritage turn
drive
you
to
being a witch hunter?
Yeah. Well, and the thing that I find crazy, right, is it's in the episode, right? They have this weird thing. They forget to give us any context for this man or his actions.
Yeah.
They just say, oh, well, the minute we find out about this family connection, well, that explains the form his madness took. Yeah, but why is he crazy?
Yeah, but why is he doing this? Why is he crazy? What they were...
What was the stressor?
Parents? Like, exactly. All he had to do was add in why his parents got killed or whatever. Or maybe, well, no,
like,
parents,
maybe the adoptive parents were horrifically, maybe his adoptive parents were horrific religious nuts who monstrously abused him.
Yeah.
And then he, like, spent his life trying to figure out, well, what was the cause of their madness? Why did I get all this abuse? Then he looks into his own, oh, I found out I'm adopted. Oh, I found out the truth is that I'm from this line of witch hunters. Oh my God, my parents must have been demons.
Yeah.
Trying to keep me away from my true duty
calling.
In life,
yeah.
My true calling, and there you go. I have just fixed this for them.
Yeah, and then that's all, because you don't have a clue. You don't have a single clue. Like,
about
why
how
did he,
any of this started.
Yeah, why did he kill the guy who, the creepy guy?
I don't know. I mean,
there's absolutely no reason. Why, like when you look at that standing away, you say, okay, so he kept the creepy guy so he could have access to the girl, but the girl wasn't involved with the creepy guy, didn't want any part of the creepy guy, so what's going on here? Like why did he kill the creepy guy? I don't know. The creepy guy wasn't a demon, was he? Or maybe he was a demon, but if he was a demon who was trying to have sex with a witch, why should he care? Unless he's killing all demons. But he's not killing demons. He's killing witches.
Yeah, and more to the point, like, they have this whole narrative of, like, well, it turns out this woman had was living with her boyfriend before marriage, and this other woman was doing cocaine. Maybe he's a moral avenger. But, of course, this killer had no way to know about any of that stuff. No.
And why in God's name would he be a moral avenger when they already know the rocks?
Yeah, the rocks.
They already know that the other woman was hanged.
But then we get, well, no, the man, woman was rocks, woman was pushed off a cliff, oh, man pushed was off hanged. A cliff,
yes, yeah. The man was hanged.
But the thing that really gets me is they then, at the last minute, are like, oh my god, what if he uses the book as a lure and anyone who interacts with the book, he decides must be a witch and he kills them? And I'm like, that is so far out of left field.
Yeah.
That is just baffling to watch, especially because, and I can't stress this enough, when you watch the scene, first off, I don't know, you can make the argument that lady, right, didn't deserve to get her head smashed in for messing with his book. But I would make a counter argument to tell you this. Who on earth, like, this is obviously a book he brought from home to, like, have be at the library for people to look at. It's his property. What is she doing entering his property into the system and letting people take out the book? Yeah, you're a lending library. You know what you're not full of? Frigging 17th century texts on witch finders. You're just a regular library. What is she doing, like, looking at this obviously ancient leather-bound valuable book and it's like, I'll just stick a barcode in there, it's fine. Like, no, on some level I'm like, yeah, maybe that lady did need to get her head smashed in with a typewriter.
Well, no, but
you see my point. I didn't have a ton of sympathy for a woman who treats that, for a librarian who treats that rare and significant book so cavalierly.
Yes,
I don't have a lot of sympathy for her.
Well, no. Okay. No. And I have to admit that I don't know any librarian who would ever
act like that. No.
Act like that. No. Not one. And I have known librarians all my life.
No librarian would take a man's personal property, this incredibly rare book, and stick a barcode in it and give it to a random lady. That's just not anything any librarian would ever do. But the plot needs a reason for him to go after that mother and child, so there you go.
Yeah, but that still doesn't give him a reason to kill the woman. Right?
No, so. Well, no, but he just decides, no, yeah, he decides that, oh, well, because she touched the book, she must be trying to steal the book because she's a witch, blah, 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 blah. And the weird part is, you actually have a moment where you could get into this guy's psychopathy and, like, how, you know, messed up he is when she tries to come up with an alibi to save her daughter.
That was wonderful. That scene was good.
It's a good scene.
I loved
and that. Had that actually paid off,
yes,
and him actually let the little girl go, that would have been great writing.
Yeah.
But then they don't.
No.
Like, then they just undermine that scene by having, no, I'm going to burn the girl anyway.
Okay. This was going to be the guy who doesn't get away with it in these three episodes, who doesn't get what he wants in these three episodes.
But the thing is, it's like, at least make his insanity internally consistent. You can have him just plan to let the daughter go, and they still rush in and save the mother.
Yeah.
He doesn't have to also kill the daughter. Make it internally consistent, right? There's this moment. I don't know how much you remember.
He sees the angel wings, for heaven's sakes.
I know. Isn't that enough? Like, I don't know if you're familiar with the, how familiar you are with the movie The Dark Knight, the second Christopher Nolan Batman movie. Right? But
yes.
You're kind of familiar. We all have our problems with Heath Ledger's Joker. We don't have to get into it. But what I think is fundamentally, right?
Yeah.
What is fundamentally wrong with that movie is, right? I have plenty of issues with how they depict the Joker and blah, blah, blah. That this is not a place for that. But my biggest problem with their treatment of the Joker and the whole movie is there's this, the ultimate plan of the Joker's is he has gotten a boat full of civilians and a boat full of prisoners, and he's going to say, at any point, one of you can blow up the other boat, right? And you will save yourselves. Or if neither of you presses the boat blow up button, you all die. Right. And so I'm going to prove, because his whole thing is about proving there's no society. There's no people looking out for each other. There is no value, right? We're all just animals. Nothing means anything. He is the purest kind of nihilist, right? And that's what he's been trying to prove this whole time. There is no goodness. There is no morality. There's nothing. We're all just animals. So what does any of it matter? That is the Joker's point, right? And so when Batman is coming to kill him, oh my God. And now I got my stuff getting in there. When Batman is coming to capture him, we actually get the time runs out and neither of the boats pushes the button because they decide that even if it means they all have to blow up, they can't be mass murderers.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And the Christopher Nolan's mistake is he doesn't have the Joker react to this information.
Yeah.
Now, the Joker's entire worldview has just been invalidated by the citizens of Gotham.
Yep.
And he doesn't have the Joker react to that at all. And in the same way, this guy has just been offered for the first time proof. He has been offered proof, and he doesn't react to it in the way that someone with his mental illness would react.
Yeah.
Because the show just needs him to be irredeemably monstrous and him to be a dragon for them to slay. And they can't even allow for internal consistency in their own villain. And that drives me crazy at the end of this episode. Her playing into his Matt delusion is such a good scene.
Yep. It's brilliant.
It is a complete betrayal of the episode and that scene's writing to have him still try to kill the daughter.
Yeah. As I said, there are so many things at the end that betray the whole episode. I just did the one.
Yeah.
You know, which,
right?
Yeah. And it's just like, no. I wonder about these writers, right? They just don't think this through because they actually have him see the angel mark.
I know.
Now,
so?
She knows because the mother knows. His delusion will make him see the angel mark if she says that her daughter is a witch hunter.
She knows she has a birthmark.
Yeah.
She knows the daughter has a birthmark and she knows she can convince him because he's obviously insane. And she does. And then the show just throws that moment, that beautiful moment.
Yeah.
She just throws it away.
I know. And I was so mad. There's so many things I could have bought about this episode, but that because the end with the Day of the Dead celebration and the beginning and the end is okay. I mean, I can even overlook his Clint Eastwood. I mean, he's probably never seen the movie. So
yes, he's just basing it on someone else's memory.
It's someone else's memory. He hasn't seen the movie and he has an eidetic memory. So therefore he wouldn't get it right.
What someone told him. Yeah,
he would get it wrong. So somebody told him the wrong thing, right?
Yeah, there you go.
So I'm going to forgive Reed for that.
Okay.
But those are the two things. I mean, you get this wonderful, wonderful scene with the mother willing to die to save her daughter. And she buys into his entire delusion. She says, yes, I'm a witch. I'm sorry, but my daughter is a witch hunter finder as well. Is a witch hunter.
She is born into witch finding just like you were.
Yes. Right.
You know?
And she just goes it all the way. And then the show just completely destroys it where they could have had a show that would be a B+, maybe even an A-
episode. And they throw it away at that last minute.
At that last minute. And I'm just.
And the thing is, you can say, if we had learned all about his childhood and why he's killing people, you could even maybe explain why he needs to kill the daughter anyway.
Yeah.
But because they're willing to spend no time doing that, we're asked to just accept, well, this is the form his madness has taken. Great. Why isn't his madness consistent then?
Yeah. Then his madness. Because you know what I keep thinking about is frailty.
Oh.
Right? It's so funny. For whatever reason, this episode gives me visions of frailty.
What do you mean,
frailty?
For whatever reason? It's completely obvious why this gives you visions of frailty.
True.
If you haven't seen Frailty, the late Bill Paxton, he did not direct a lot of movies.
Yeah.
But he did direct Frailty, and Frailty is a small M masterpiece of just beautiful, not only horror storytelling, but a great look at the biblical morality.
Yeah.
Right? And how biblical morality affects people. Like, essentially, if anyone tells you they take the Bible literally, make them watch the movie Frailty. And then talk to them later about what taking the Bible literally means.
Yeah.
Because it is the idea of what happens if you become a prophet of the Lord in today, in today's context.
Yeah. Anyway.
What does it mean to be called to the service of God in the modern day? And does that make you an insane person? And I'm not going to say anything more about the plot if you haven't seen it.
And
it is
you really
so good.
And you really want to see Matthew McConaughey.
Oh, my no.
And
he's so good in that movie. Powers Booth, Matthew McConaughey.
And Bill Paxton, of course.
Bill Paxton, of course, yeah. And the two kids.
It was just it is a gem of a movie. We've talked about it before, but it bears, when you see this episode, it bears watching, because it is internally consistent, and this one didn't have to do much to make you believe that this guy believed that he wasn't just a crazy killer. He was a witch finder, and when he saw the angel
he should have taken that as seriously as all of his madness suggests he must.
Yes, he must. Because he must, and it is, you know, and the mother even goes so far as to say that the daughter is keeping her
from doing evil. Yep.
Right?
You have 80% of a great episode here, and then the 20% completely undermines everything
good you
did.
And that it bothered me. It made me sad.
It's sad. I mean, it's frustrating, and you watch it. I mean, I remembered, and it's like, as I'm watching the episode, I'm like, why didn't I like this episode? This seems like I'm annoyed that it's taken them so long to figure out the witch stuff, but why didn't I like this episode? And then we get to the end, and I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
They ruin it right at the end.
And there's no reason to do it. I think, you know, I often wonder why we watch, and but this week I'm going, okay, this is sort of why we still watch the show, because sometimes you have, like with In the Blood, right? That episode, there were problems with it, but you know, it was such a good, this is what I keep telling everybody, it was such a good ending, you tend to overlook the rest of it.
Totally.
Right?
But here, an ending, a bad ending. Well, the thing is,
an episode.
You want to hear the crazy part? Is I was listening to, I was just listening to a podcast with Shane Black talking about Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. And what he said was that, I mean, he loves that movie. He loved making it. He loves everything about that movie. But he said was how torturous coming up with the right ending was, right? Because, and he said something that a lot of people who know about screenwriting will say, that it's like, you can have the best movie in the world, and if people don't like the ending, they think it's a bad movie.
Yeah.
And you can have the worst movie in the world, but if people walk out of the movie feeling great, they'll tell their friends, I enjoyed that movie. And that's why he's like, that's why I worked so hard and so long figuring out how to end the movie.
Yeah. It's the same thing we keep saying about this show. There are shows that have flaws in them, left, right, and center, but I tell you, when you walk away at the end of the show and you either feel gratified because the bad guy has been done in.
Yep.
Okay. Or they have managed to save the one that you want them to save, right?
Yep.
Or you actually do truly feel sorry for someone you should feel sorry for.
Yeah. The Adam episode.
Yeah.
You know? There's bad stuff in there, but it's like fundamentally you care about what happened to Adam.
Yeah. And that's it. And I go back to what I couldn't believe. Let me go back to my special features. what I couldn't believe in the inspired inspiration.
The inspiration and the inspired. Yeah.
Was that they actually thought that they actually insisted that you have to understand and feel sorry for the murderers. And
I don't.
I'm going.
For a second.
Not for a second. Do you not understand what you've done? I don't feel sorry for Cameron Manheim.
No, I don't feel sorry for her. I don't feel sorry for either of the twin sons. What episode do you think you made?
Yeah.
And that's the thing. What episode? And this is, I hate to go back to Joker again, right? But I will say this. It's funny because Joaquin Phoenix said the opposite thing about his performance in Joker, which is how challenging he found it to try and create a character that the audience couldn't sympathize with. And by comparison, like, you watch The Inspiration and The Inspired, not only do you not care about these men.
No.
You can't point to a moment in the episode where you're supposed to care about these men. Like, what in either of these episodes did you think was going to get me on these guys' side? And by comparison, by comparison, you've got in talking about making the movie Joker, Joaquin Phoenix saying it's difficult trying to create a character that specifically the audience can't identify with. When you see this movie, you're going to see, because you haven't seen it yet, when you see this movie, you're going to be like, every moment of this movie is designed and crafted to get you on this guy's side, to get you on the Joker's side. Okay. Every second of the film exists only to get you on his side and make you empathize with his plight. To ridiculous degrees. So it's like, you have the two sides of this, where it's like, you've got, on one thing, these people who make the most abhorrent person I've ever seen on an episode of Criminal Minds,
Yeah. And
they think you empathize with him. And then on the other side, you've got a guys who make an entire movie about how the Joker's really not so bad and you have to understand where he's coming from, and they think they've made a movie about a monster.
Well, no, Joaquin. Well, yeah.
Joaquin thinks he's made a movie about a monster. Okay, I'm sure Joaquin, Todd Phillips doesn't.
Okay, Joaquin may have not had a lot to do with editing of this, because so much of it is the editing. Yeah. What's really funny is I just saw Frederick Kohler this week.
Oh, what was he on?
What did I watch? And of course. Oh, NCIS.
Oh, who did he play in NCIS?
Oh, he was a killer.
He's always a killer.
Right? He was a killer, and he had a partnership with another guy. And what they would do is decide who needed to be killed. And right. So the two of them did it, yeah. Right? But one guy would be they would always do one another's murders, but it wasn't like strangers from a train. Two guys that met in school.
Oh, okay.
And they didn't kill the people they were mad at. They would kill someone close to the person they were pissed off. So those people would
suffer yeah.
for the rest of their lives. It was fascinating, but it was so funny to see him just after we had done The Inspired. And we're still mad about The Inspiration and The Inspired.
And The Inspired.
Because you don't.
By the way, I just want to point out, it's been a week. We're still mad about having to rewatch those episodes.
No, I'm sitting here going, it didn't help when I watched Kohler on NCIS, and I said, oh, well, so yeah.
Oh, there he is again.
Yeah. There he is again, playing the same god-awful, horrible monster, right? But at least NCIS. Has no illusions about whether this guy is a good guy. Out of your mind? He's, you know, and I am sure if you talk to the writers of NCIS, they would tell you the same thing. No,
yeah.
this was just a monster. Yes, you might know why he's a monster. That doesn't make him any less of a monster.
Oh.
Anyway,
so frustrating.
Yeah, so
that's this week's episodes.
and
we
had, a lot about
we had
last
more to say. Yeah. Too. We had a lot, and I guess it's crazy that we had a ton more to say about last week's episodes, but we did. Really did. So what's if people want to do the homework and watch along with us, what are they watching next week?
7, 8, and 9.
which are...
Gatekeeper. That's Matthew.
No! Oh, God, the dumbest episode of the season so far. We're going to talk a lot about that one.
Okay. Now I remember the whole thing. Never mind. Okay.
The dumbest episode.
All of a sudden, I'm sitting here going, gatekeeper. Okay. Oh, yes. Okay. Now I remember this whole thing. Yes.
Oh, so
This is one of those ones where we could spend a lot of time talking about this one.
We might.
Yeah. And then the next one is The Return.
What is The Return?
When Chicago, Illinois teenage runaway dies after gunning down three civilians at a diner.
Oh, okay, yeah, the American cop ISIS, right? Okay,
yeah.
All right,
yeah,
and the next one,
and then Strange Fruit.
Oh, Virgil Williams, right?
No, this
Sherman Berwa.
Yeah,
Berwa. Next week's gonna be a hefty week. Let's just say that next week is gonna have a lot to talk about.
I don't know. I guess I'm gonna have to bring. This because...
The episodes, yeah. We're going to have to talk about this ASAP. All right, so if you are watching along with us, that is your homework, 907 to 909. There's some interesting episodes in there that I am intrigued to see what my co-host here has to say about them.
Well,
but
we'll get there. After we got through the inspired and inspiration, we're starting to get back. I'm starting to
back
feel
into
it
the
again.
Swing of things. I know, right? Yeah, but no, it was our own fault for taking the extended break and then having to come back to those two episodes. Yeah. If we power through, it's much easier to start season 10 than it is to start season 9. It is so crazy to think that even she understood the necessity of coming back on your strongest foot, but then she thought that was their strongest foot.
Yes.
What is wrong with you, Erica? What is wrong with your brain?
No,
There is a book in this.
Well, we have to. I've been thinking about this.
Well, we're going to be finished doing the podcast at some point soon, so there might be a book in this.
We may start writing a book because we can just have the chapter on. Well, one of the things Criminal Minds thinks is that all cops, except for the BAU, are stupid.
Yeah, there's so many instances.
Start to look at, okay, what is consistent across the board of 15 years of Criminal Minds?
What are their opinions about, like, what is the story they're telling? And that's what Meta Read is all about, is what is the story you're telling in the entirety of this?
Yeah.
But again, that is something we're going to address as we go forward.
Yeah.
Now,
anyway.
check out those episodes if you need to, if you have any questions for us, if you have any suggestions for profiling related fiction you think we should check out, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at profiling@criminalminds@gmail.com. And if you are listening to this on a podcast client, an iTunes, a iHeartRadio, whatever, be sure to put a rating on the podcast, which helps people find it. Because if you enjoy it, I'm sure someone else might as well. Or maybe you hate us and want to give us to someone you hate. That's fine, too. Maybe you hate listening to us the way we hate
Criminal Minds.
And that sounds crazy, but I have people who hate read the reviews, so...
Yeah, they do.
Hate read every review because it makes them so mad. I don't quite get it, but maybe they have as complicated a relationship with my reviews as I do with Criminal Minds, if you want to go down a meta hole.
Yeah.
But anyway, so we will see you back next week. As always, I want to thank you for listening and say that until next time, I've been Dan.
And I've been Dr. Redmond. And have a good weekend.
Au revoir.
Profiling Criminal Minds is a member of the Kinks Podcasting Network.